Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Vayetze, 5768. We're studying the Parsha with an eye for the Sefer Mesilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just. This week we did have a quote directly from the Parsha. The Parsha deals with Yaakov Avinu and his travels outside of the land of Israel, in the Galut, in the exile. Yaakov spent 20 years of his total 147 years living with his uncle, Lavan. And that is where he worked. That is where he met his wives, Rachel and Leah. That is where he married and had most of his large family. 11 out of the 12 tribes of Israel were born with Lavan. And Yaakov served Lavan as his shepherd for those years, 20 years. There is an encounter towards the end of the story when Yaakov is already on his way back to the land of Israel. The story goes, Yaakov sees that Lavan is actually jealous because Yaakov has become very wealthy, and it was not due to any good intentions or any wages that he earned with Lavan. In fact, Lavan, as we will see in the conversation, was a swindler. He was a first-class cheat, and he would not pay Yaakov. And all of the wealth that Yaakov had amassed, he did on his own with a miraculous blessing from God. And he sees that Lavan is becoming increasingly bitter and jealous of him, and he sees that it's time to leave. And the only way he can really leave is by just running away. And so he gathers his wives and he tells them and his children, he says, you know, your father is no longer fond of me. I'm ready to go back to Israel. Are you ready to come? And they say, yes. And so basically, in the night, they steal away. And Lavan was not aware of it at the time. Well, when Lavan finds out about it, he's incensed and he runs after Yaakov. We're told that Hashem had to make an emergency appearance to Lavan, even though Lavan, of course, is not worthy of prophecy, but he had to warn him not to harm Yaakov, which is what he would have liked to do. And thus, when Lavan finally does meet up with Yaakov, he seems to be acting very cordial. He says to him, verse 26, Lavan said to Yaakov, "What have you done that you have deceived me and led my daughters away like captives of the sword? Why have you fled so stealthily and cheated me?" Look who's talking. "Nor did you tell me, for I would have sent you off with gladness, with songs, with timbrel, and with lyre. You did not allow me to kiss my sons and daughters. Now you have acted foolishly. It is in my power to do you all harm. But the God of your father addressed me last night, saying, beware of speaking with Jacob, either good or bad." And then there was another little grievance that he had. One of his idols was missing. And in truth, it was stolen by Rachel for Lavan's own good, because she knew the falsehood of the idolatry that she grew up with. So Lavan now takes that up and he says, "Why did you steal my God?" And Yaakov says, "You know, you can search my tent." Yaakov didn't realize that Rachel had stolen it. "You can look anywhere you want." And he doesn't find anything, because Rachel had hidden it. But finally, Yaakov lays into Lavan. And listen to these words. And within these words, within these few verses that I'm going to read, is quoted in the Mesilas Yesharim. "Then Jacob became angered, and he took up his grievance with Lavan. Jacob spoke up and said to Lavan, 'What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? When you rummaged through all my things, what did you find of all your household objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen. Let them decide between the two of us. Do you have any claim against me, Lavan? Have I ever taken anything of yours? These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I eat rams of your flock." In other words, I was a meticulously ethical and honest and filled with integrity as an employee of yours. That which was mangled I never brought you. I myself would bear the loss. For me you would exact it, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. In some cases Yaakov even went beyond the letter of the law and absorbed the losses of the sheep. This is how I was. By day, scorching heat consumed me. Frost by night, my sleep drifted from my eyes. This is my 20 years in your household. I served you 14 years for your two daughters. That was the deal that they had made. Of course, Lavan cheated him. We know the story, that he worked for 7 years for Rachel, and Lavan substituted her for Leah. So he had to work another 7 years. 6 years for your flocks. And you changed my wage 100 times. You never kept up your end of the deal. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the dread of Isaac been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. Had you had your way, I would have been a poor man. God saw my wretchedness and the toil of my hands, so he admonished you last night. So Yaakov gives it to Lavan, but good. Here Lavan is making out like he was the one who was cheated, he was the one who was wronged, that Jacob was unloyal, and Yaakov puts Lavan in his place and says, Lavan, who's the loyal one and who's the disloyal one? So in reference to this, the Mesillas Yesharim, in chapter 11, which we have actually studied before, back in the Parsha of Noach, where we learned about the virtue of cleanliness, that's the third level, vigilance, then comes zealousness or alacrity, and then comes cleanliness, the level at which people seek to be meticulous about the observance of mitzvot, not just the general things, but the specific things, being very exacting. And he discusses many, many areas of Torah observance. We spoke about the one related to monetary matters. And in connection with that, in that discussion of being meticulous in monetary matters, Rabbi Luzzatto quotes this verse about Yaakov. I'll read a couple of lines here. How should a wage worker conduct himself? Person's working for somebody else. His time has been paid for. His time has been hired. So he cites the fact that in the Talmud, a wage worker did not even have to say the entire grace after meals, after his lunch, because it would take too much time away from his employer. If he had to say the Shema, he only had to do the first paragraph, not the whole thing. He cites an example of the Talmud, Tanis, concerning Abba Chilkiah, a very, very pious sage. He would not even answer the greeting of Torah scholars if he was in the middle of work. And then he gets to Yaakov Avinu. And Yaakov Avinu, may peace be upon him, states it explicitly when speaking to his father-in-law, Bereishis 31:40. In the daytime I was consumed by drought, in the evening by frost, and my eyes were deprived of sleep. Okay, there is our connection. And therefore, Rabbi Luzzatto says, so what will they say, those who are busy with their own pleasures while they're supposed to be at work, attending to their jobs, but they're really off doing other things, taking two-hour lunch breaks, or whatever it is, or who are occupied with enriching their pockets at their employer's expense? Okay, that's the particular aspect that Rabbi Luzzatto is discussing. Integrity in the workplace. Yaakov Avinu is unparalleled throughout Jewish history. It is his work ethic that becomes the basis in Talmudic law of the laws of faithful workmanship. This little soliloquy right here is quoted by the Talmud, and it becomes the basis of much of the civil law in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. So certainly we can say that from this parsha, from this incident, and it is borne out in the Mesillas Yesharim, we learn from Yaakov how to be honest, how to be faithful, and how to be careful and be scrupulous with other people's money. Okay, that is a lesson worthy of a class all of its own. But there's something else that I believe that Yaakov Avinu is teaching us here. A whole new dimension of what he went through and what he accomplished in these 20 years. There's a very famous quote in Rashi at the beginning of next week's Parsha, Parshas Vayishlach. I've cited this Rashi several times before. At the beginning of Vayishlach, Yaakov is on his way back to Israel, and he knows that he is going to be encountering his brother Esav. He goes from one enemy to another enemy. And in preparation for that encounter, he sends messengers to Esav. And he charges the angels, not the angels, the messengers, saying, I think Rashi says that maybe the messengers were angels, but whatever the case may be, thus shall you say, to my lord Esav, so said your servant Yaakov. Actually, the sages are questioning why he chose to be so placating to Esav, calling himself Esav's servant. Perhaps Yaakov may have gone overboard and maybe he actually suffered for that later on. But anyway, that's not our discussion now. Say to Esav the following, I, Yaakov, have sojourned with Lavan and have lingered until now. I have been living with Lavan. Okay, what's the point? Says Rashi, Im Lavan garti, I have lived with Lavan. The word garti, I have lived, are comprised of the four letters that coincide with the mnemonic Taryag. If you say garti and you switch around the letters, it's Taryag. Taryag is the mnemonic for 613, referring to the mitzvot in the Torah. Garti begematria Taryag. So his point in saying this is, Im Lavan harasha garti, I lived with Lavan the Russia, with Lavan the evil one, the Taryag mitzvot shamarti. But all the while, I was adherent to the 613 commandments. V'lo lamadati mima'asav haroim. And I did not learn from his evil ways. So you better watch out, Esav. I am still on my high spiritual level as I was when I left. Don't think that maybe I've gone into exile and I have become just another Jake. I have lived with Lavan, the worst possible influence who undermines the whole Mida of MS of truth, and I am still adherent. And I have not learned from his evil ways. So, let's look at these two perspectives. On one hand, Yaakov is rebuking Lavan for being dishonest and crediting himself, which, by the way, it's not bragging, it's not gloating. The Talmud teaches that if somebody is suspected of doing a wrong that he did not do, it is an obligation for him to clear himself and demonstrate that he did not do that wrong. So if Lavan is saying to Yaakov, you cheated me, it is Yaakov's duty to turn it around and say, no, I did not cheat you, you cheated me. So he's not gloating.
How do you do 613 mitzvahs when one in Israel?
Well, that's another discussion. There are a lot of mitzvahs that he couldn't have done. He shamarti, he adhered to them. That means he studied them, he internalized them, and he did as much as he could in action. Whatever he couldn't do in action, he did in thought, which is a whole other discussion. It's an interesting concept. But, on one hand, he's rebuking Lavan. On the other hand, what he's confiding is, boy, was that a test for me to live with such a scoundrel and not be dragged down by his low, unscrupulous ways. He's saying to Esav, you know what I've accomplished in 20 years? My accomplishment has been to try to avoid sinking to Esav's level. That was my nisayon. That was my test. Do you know how hard it was for me to be honest when the person that I'm supposed to be honest to is being dishonest? He's cheating me. What would be the natural reaction? He's cheating me? I'll cheat him. Why should I treat him better than he treats me? Wouldn't that have been the natural human response? That's what Yaakov was really struggling with. It's one thing to be honest with honest people. But to be honest with dishonest people, that is a monumental Herculean feat. Yaakov is teaching us a different lesson. Besides the lesson of honesty, he's teaching us the lesson of maintaining one's own standards of morality, even when one is surrounded by people that don't have those standards of morality. Now that happens to be another very important lesson stressed in the Mesilas Yesharim. So I think that we have a double lesson today. Now Yaakov Avinu is not quoted in that regard, but let's look at this a little bit. Going back to the first level, the first quality, the quality of, what is the first quality in the ladder of the Mesilas Yesharim? Vigilance. Very good. Arthur's doing his homework.
By alacrity.
Followed by alacrity, followed by
cleanliness.
Excellent. So what is the quality of vigilance? Vigilance is the quality of doing what's right. Page 14, in the introduction of the virtue of vigilance, the concept of vigilance relates to a person's actions and affairs. He must contemplate and survey his actions and his conduct to see whether they are good or not, so as not to risk the loss of his soul, heaven forbid. And he must not pursue his habits thoughtlessly, the way a blind man walks as in darkness. That's what vigilance is. Doing what's right and having the forethought to think about whether he's doing what's right. The best way not to do what's right is to not think at all. Just to walk and go about our business without thinking. And it's not so hard to do. So that's the virtue of vigilance. Now, the way that Rabbi Luzzatto structures his book, if he's dealing with a particular virtue or a particular quality, such as vigilance, he doesn't just explain what the concept is. He explains it, and then he explains it even more when he shows the different aspects. Chapter 3, the elements of vigilance, shows how it applies in different arenas in our life. And then Chapter 4, acquiring vigilance, how does a person actually train himself to be vigilant. And even one more step is chapter 5. Chapter 5 is factors that undermine vigilance and how to avoid them. Because as we know, we've spoken many times before, living in the world and trying to live a good life as defined by Torah, there's a tremendous offensive strategy that is required, but all the while to remember that there's also a defense that's working against us. I'm borrowing that term from sports. It's hard enough to try to execute an offensive play, but to do it with people that are trying to block you, that makes it even harder. So here we are trying to be vigilant and trying to employ all of the positive methods and strategies, and at the same time we have these factors that are working against us, trying to make us unvigilant. So what are those factors that undermine our vigilance? And how can we avoid those factors? I wonder if, in, let's say, football, does the coach train the offensive players how to avoid the defensive players?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they don't just say, go out and catch the ball. They say, you're going to go out to catch the ball, right? The cornerback is going to be standing over here, right? You have to fake him out and run this way, and the quarterback will find you. I don't know. But there's a sophisticated process in how to execute an offense. So chapter 5, factors that undermine vigilance and how to avoid them. There are three factors that undermine vigilance. Page 31. They undermine this virtue and prevent one from attaining it. The first is involvement and preoccupation with worldly matters. The second, frivolity and derision, which is basically an attitude of making light of things, not taking things seriously. That's an attitude. The first one is too busy. The second one is you don't have a serious attitude. The third one is bad company. Who are you hanging around? These are the three factors, and that's what's fantastic about Rabbi Luzzatto's book, is that he's taken into account all of the different affairs of the world and has been able to crystallize and break it down into components. What is it that we have to accomplish in terms of growing and improving, and what are the things that we have to focus on, what are the things that we have to defend ourselves against? It's the structure, it's the breaking down of the task, which is just so breathtaking. So if you want to avoid the factors that are going to try to make you unvigilant, these are the three. These are the three big ones. Too busy, not a serious attitude, and bad company. And it's the bad company which I think is the lesson from Yaakov. Because Yaakov Avinu spent 20 years in bad company. He was living in a society, in a household, where the name of the game is, see how much you can take away from the other guy. See how much you can get away with. See how much you can exploit, take advantage of others for your personal gain. That was the rule of the household. His name.
It took him 20 years to figure that out.
I can't tell you why he was there for 20 years. It took him 20 years to pass that test. What he was saying to Lavan at the end of the 20 years was not just, you were dishonest and I was honest. What he was also saying to him is, you were a bad influence on me, and I didn't succumb to it. That, I think, is the ultimate achievement. And that's what he said to Esav. Im Lavan garti, and I was living with Lavan, v'lo lamadati mimasav harayim, and I didn't learn from his evil ways. That's why you better watch out, Esav. That is my trophy that I've come back from the battlefield with. That's my badge of honor. I have not learned to be like Esav. And Rabbi Luzzatto talks about this third factor. That's the one I wanted to focus on. The first two are important also. In fact, once we're mentioning in the context of Yaakov, the antidote to being too busy is taking off time from our busy schedules and making a time and a place in our lives for study and reflection. That is the antidote. We're too busy? Stop. Friday afternoon, get to the class, or whenever it may be, once a day, have some alone time, take out your Mesilas Yesharim, ask yourselves these questions. As we said in the beginning of chapter 2, ask ourselves daily, or at least weekly, are my actions and conduct good or not? And in chapter 3 he says, I have to first ask myself, what is good? What is the good that a person should choose? What is the evil that he should flee from? And then, how do my deeds rate with that definition? Are my deeds consistent with the true good that I define, or with the evil? Just thinking. Just making the time to think. And if you're too busy, you're not going to have time to study. You're not going to know what is the true good. And you're not going to even think whether you're doing it or not. We see that Yaakov Avinu did that also, because it's also pretty well known that before Yaakov even went to live with Laban, and this is incredible, he was already 63 years old. He had already been studying in the tents of the sages for his whole life. And what does he do before going to live with Laban, according to the famous Midrash? He went to study in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver for 14 more years. Got nothing better to do now. He's only running for his life. Esav is about to kill him. Plus, it'd be nice to get married, settle down. No. I've got to study for 14 years because I have to prepare myself, because I know that when I get to Lavan, the bad influence is going to be there. I'm going to be in the bad company of this crook. And I better study, but good. I better get myself prepared to know what good is, to know how to, you know, he probably read this book. Yaakov Avinu probably studied Mesilas Yesharim 100 times. I mean, it wasn't written yet. But don't you think Yaakov knew everything that was in here? He had to know all this. So he teaches us the first lesson. Don't be too busy to spend the time to figure out what's the game plan. And as far as the second factor, which detracts from vigilance, the bad attitude, not being serious. Yaakov was plenty serious. Don't take out 14 years if you're not serious. And now, as far as the third factor, bad company, listen to what Mesilas Yesharim has to say about that. The third factor leading to the loss of vigilance is the company one keeps, i.e., being in the company of fools and sinners. This is what is stated in Scripture. Mishle, he who befriends a fool will be broken. Even after a person has understood his obligation to serve the Eternal and the need for vigilance in this area, We often see that he becomes lax about his duties or transgresses in some of them. Why? In order to avoid ridicule by his friends or to gain access to their company. It's called peer pressure, one of the strongest forces known to man. I don't even know if Superman could break that force. This is what Shlomo cautions, saying, "Do not mingle with those who alter the ways of the Eternal." Now, you might hear a little voice inside of you that says, "But shouldn't a person's demeanor always be oriented towards people? Shouldn't I be a worldly kind of person? Shouldn't I be involved? Shouldn't I mingle? Shouldn't I be friendly?" You must say to him, "This applies when people act human, but not when people act like animals." Yes, you should be involved with people. People that act like people. Shlomo further cautions in Mishlei, "Keep your distance from the fool." King David said, "Praiseworthy is the man who did not walk in the counsel of the wicked, in the path of sinners did not stand, and in the seat of the scornful did not sit." And the sages comment, noting the three different modes of contact, walking, standing, sitting. The sages comment, if a person just walks near them, he's going to end up stopping and listening, maybe getting involved in a conversation. And if he stands with them, he will eventually sit with them. Also in Tehillim, "I have not sat among false people. I will not associate with those who conceal their actions. I despise the congregation of evildoers." All that is required from a person then is to purify and cleanse himself, refrain from following in the footsteps of the masses who are immersed in the vanities of the times. Simultaneously, he must direct himself toward the precincts of the Eternal and his dwelling places. As David himself concludes, "I will wash my hands in purity and then I will encircle your altar, O Eternal." What if it turns out that he does find himself in their company and they start to ridicule him? That's where the test gets really strong. You should not let it bother him. On the contrary, he should ridicule and denigrate his scoffers. He should imagine this. This is a strategy that a person could use. What if he had an opportunity to make a lot of money, but in order to make the money, he would have to do something that people would ridicule him for? Would he not do it? He would say to the people, "Go ahead, laugh. You'll see who has the last laugh. I'm going to be rich." How much more, then, should he not be willing to lose his soul because of ridicule? And that is why our sages emphasize, teach us in Pirkei Avos, "Be bold as a leopard to do the will of your Father in heaven." That's what it means to be bold and to be strong. Strong like a lion. Because it takes inner strength to do what's right. Because everybody else is going to laugh at you. And you're going to become unpopular. King David was a king. And you know who he rubbed shoulders with? All the other kings. What do you think they talked about when they got together at their king conventions? The Psalms?
Crowns.
Right. The talk of most kings were focused on grandiose and pleasurable matters. David, who was also a king, would have found it an embarrassment, while in the company of such people, if he were to discuss matters of ethics and Torah, instead of talking about the grandiose and the pleasurable. All kings want to talk about their next conquest. And David says, "How about a Dvar Torah?" But after having already attained the truth, he was not concerned about this at all and was not tempted in his heart by these vanities. Rather, he explicitly states, "And I will speak of your testimonies before kings, and I will not be ashamed." That's what it takes to be a growing Jew, a Jew who is trying to get on that path and stay on that path. One of the biggest tests is the test of our environment, and it is always going to be pushing us in the other direction unless we have the great foresight and fortitude to stick with good company, with people that are going to encourage us and help us go along the path. That should be our first choice, but it's not always possible, and then we have to learn from Yaakov Avinu and from the Rabbi Lasato that this is one of the most formidable tests and one of the greatest areas of challenge and ultimately of growth. is to know what's right, to do what's right, even though people around you are scoffing. And if we can do that, then we can turn to all the people of the world, the Esavs and the Lavans, and we can say, you didn't defeat us. Not only are we honest, we didn't learn from your ways, and we can stand up proudly in front of them without being ashamed, and then ultimately we can stand up before God and say, God, we passed your test. That is a lesson from Yaakov Avinu. And now we will hear from Arthur.
Well, there's so many paradoxes here. It's pretty wild, I think.
Okay.
Well, the two immediately spring to mind. One is this notion of responding to evil with goodness and kindness and maybe silence. It seems to me that sort of led to the slaughter of the Jewish people not too many years ago. So that's, I find, very troubling. And secondly, the notion that on the one hand, and I think the Talmud even suggests we are free to be wicked with wicked people, and maybe even encouraged to do that. So I'm interested in your thoughts about that. The second one is...
What's the first point again? About being silent?
About responding to evil with goodness and kindness is the way Yaakov did with Lavan.
Yeah, and the challenge is that got us in trouble?
Yeah, the challenge is that we were silent in the face of evil.
Are you talking about self-defense when we are being threatened physically?
Or when property is taken from us, or when we're slandered and vilified? Should we just roll over and not say anything about that, or should we get up on our hind legs?
That's what Yaakov did, of course. But why not? We can always rebuke. There's nothing wrong with rebuking. On the contrary, King David was outspoken in front of the kings. Yaakov laid into Lavan. There's nothing that says you shouldn't rebuke. You shouldn't retaliate. In other words, you shouldn't respond to evil with evil. We shouldn't say, well, if this is how you're treating us, then we're going to treat you the same way. That's the challenge. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with standing up and saying the truth. Right?
Not killing them if they want to kill us?
That's a different question. That's self-defense. That is a physical combat question. We're not talking in the arena of physical threat. It's a totally different conversation. We're talking about the moral threats. You want to cheat us? Human response might naturally be to cheat them. That's where you have to stand up. We're not talking about self-defense.
Quick second paradox. This notion of insulating ourselves from people who are not like us. And this is one of the things that we're being asked to do, too. It's important that our peer group be appropriate. On the one hand, we're asked to do that. On the other hand, we're told that as Jewish people, we should be a light to other people. We should be... And how can you do that if you're not interacting with other people, for goodness sakes? If you're just inward-looking and you isolate yourself from other people, how are we an example or a light to other people?
First of all, because they are still looking at us, especially nowadays, with worldwide communication. And second of all, that was never given to us as our obligation. It was a prophecy. It's in Isaiah, and it's primarily speaking about the end of days in the Messianic era. And it's a prophecy. It is saying, if you will adhere to the Torah, you will be a light unto the nations. It's not a charge. It's not a commandment that says, go out there and become a light. There's no such commandment in the Torah. The commandment in the Torah is do what is right, even though that's not what's being done around you. That's what we're commanded to do more than anything else. But they will see. They will see. Now, a question I think Eddie raised is how long should you wait before giving that rebuke? I mean, why did it take Yaakov so long to lay into Lavan? It's a good question. Part of it is because he had committed himself to work for him. And so there was nothing for him to say. I mean, he still has to do the work. He committed himself for 7 years. He committed himself for another 7 years, and apparently another 6 years. So he had to do his duty. That's part of his greatness, that he says, even though I shouldn't tolerate you, but I made a commitment, so I'm going to live by it. Okay? Now, if God had told him to go back earlier or whatever, that would have been the case. For some reason, he had to be there for 20 years. I don't know why 20 years. But no, a person could stand up and say what is right. you know, you have to sometimes know when is the right time and place. Sometimes it's better not to say. Mm-hmm. If they're going to kill you, then don't say it. Keep it to yourself. But sometimes there's a time to speak.
Rabbi, when you say Yaakov Avinu...
Yes, Yaakov Avinu, our father. He's our father because it's not only a question of learning from him. He's our father. He has bequeathed these qualities to us. We inherit them. That means we have within us the power and the potential to do what he did. That's what it means, he's our father. You inherit traits from your father. So we have it within us. Yes.
I mean, the exact words that you mentioned from the Parsha, Yosef said, I have been here and with Potiphar's wife, and I have not strayed. It was identical words.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and where did Yosef learn? His entire learning was with his father.
For sure. That's right. You're talking about when he said, there's one point where he says, I don't know if he's saying it to her or if he's saying it to himself, but here my master has entrusted me with his whole household, and how can I do this to him and also sin against God? Is that the one? Or is it
I'm not
different?
Sure. I thought he said to himself that I have been in this situation and I have not strayed.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Yaakov said.
Right.
So it's already in the next generation.
Oh yeah. And that was the struggle of the exile, because we were among the Egyptians. And before we had the Torah, before we had this game plan and the playbook, we were sinking. And that's when it came time for the Exodus. God basically said, I have to take them out now or else they'll be lost, because they will cease to have that distinction. And then it will be too late for them to get the Torah. Rabbi Weinberg, that's all, used to say, how can we survive spiritually and morally in exile if the Jewish people couldn't in Mitzrayim? And his answer was, because their exile was before they got the Torah. Our exile is after. So that's our weapon. We got the playbook now. Now, it's still incumbent upon us to follow the playbook, but we have the tools with which to be successful in our stand in the exile.
This is what's referred to as the 49th level of impurity.
That's right. They were almost out of it. God took them out just in time. Shkoach to everyone. Wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.